Hello, this is Michael Stone, the host of Conversations. We're committed to bringing you leading-edge thinkers in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. On our program, we look for positive solutions to local and global issues that leave you touched, moved, and inspired to action. Our weekly guests include local and global experts and concerned citizens working together to heal the wounds that separate, alienate, and marginalize people. My guest today is Jan Chosen-Bays. She's an MD, a pediatrician, a Zen teacher, and she's studied and practiced Zen since 1973. She's taught mindful eating for more than 20 years to individuals and healthcare professionals. Dr. Bays is currently on the staff of Legacy Children's Hospital in Portland, Oregon. She's also the co-abbot of the Great Vow Zen Monastery in Clatskanie, Oregon, and the author of Jizo Bodhisattva, about the great saint or Bodhisattva Jizo. And she's also got this new book that we're going to talk about today called Mindful Eating. Jan, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you. This is a subject, as you know, is very close and dear to my heart because of people in my own family who have some eating disorders and also the state of the world. You know, of course, United States alone, 2 out of 3 people are considered overweight towards obese. And I'd like to start out talking about that. Before we get into the program and that, let's talk about the problem. Give us an overview of eating in America.
Sure. Well, because I'm a pediatrician, I became quite concerned about maybe 8 years ago, because suddenly we were seeing a lot of overweight children, even overweight infants and toddlers early on in their life, in numbers that we had never seen before. And, of course, now it's become epidemic. And it's not just being overweight, but all the downstream consequences of that. So the current predictions are that children born in the year 2000 will live shorter lifespans than their parents, which is pretty alarming since our lifespan has been increasing steadily. And also that about 30% of boys and about 40% of girls will end up with type 2 diabetes. And for Latino girls, it's 50% in their lifetime. And this is a form of diabetes that we always called adult-onset diabetes because we never saw it into adulthood when people would gain weight and stop exercising and be eating too much carbohydrate and too much sweets, and then their pancreas couldn't keep up with it. And it was easily treated by changing your diet and exercising. But now we're seeing it in children. And there are consequences of this diabetes. It goes along with what we call metabolic syndrome. So it also involves hypertension, high blood cholesterol, liver disease, and kidney disease, a so-called metabolic syndrome. And we have just never seen this in children before. It's quite stunning.
Can you talk a little bit about the eating disorders, things like anorexia and bulimia, and how they get started? I'm just amazed at how many young, particularly women, have been 10, 15, 20 years of their life involved with these eating disorders.
Yes. Well, the most common eating disorders are overeating, binge eating, eating and vomiting, bulimia. But we also have this other category that you just mentioned of anorexia. And I personally think, and I just gave a talk a week ago to a group of people who treat eating disorders, nutritionists and psychologists, and I said this, and they all nodded their heads. I said, I think we're in the dark ages in terms of our understanding of anorexia. I think we understand overeating better than we understand undereating. And anorexia, well, like all diseases, I think anorexia is multifactorial. So there's a genetic component. I was at a conference in Australia where there was a woman who had been anorexic herself in her young adult years and now is an expert in treating anorexia and other eating disorders in Australia. And she said that there's clearly a genetic component to anorexia, because you can find it running in families. But the real question is, why would this gene be preserved? Why would a gene be preserved over time that keeps people from eating and makes them lose weight drastically and then possibly die from arrhythmias and so on, from nutritional deficiencies? And what they think is that because the human race over the 200,000 years or so of its evolution has faced over and over and over again famine, and that this is still part of our awareness, that any time our food source could be cut off and our lives could be in jeopardy, that in times of famine, people, and particularly women, who could be energetic and live and take care of their lives and their children when they were starving, had a genetic advantage. So that even though they were starving and they might weigh 90 pounds or 80 pounds, they were still out there getting food for their children and shelter for their children and clothing for their children and so on. So that's how this gene seems to have persisted. Interesting, isn't it?
It's very interesting. One of the questions I had as I was reading your wonderful book, which I want to plug here, called Mindful Eating, A Guide to Rediscovering a Healthy and Joyful Relationship with Food, it seemed to me that there must be, and I didn't see much in there about that, both a genetic as well as an obvious cultural aspect of it. Let's talk about the culture aspect. You know, I learned a term when I was researching for this that I'd never even heard before about bariatric medicine. And yeah, then, you know, I was studying the different malabsorption surgeries and things like that. Oh my God, you know, there's so much I didn't have any idea about. Can you talk about the cultural things that lead to this? Because this is not genetic here.
Sure, sure. Well, yeah, the cultural factors are enormous. And we can talk about those specifically in relationship to anorexia. But just to back up, when I wrote the book, I said I need to look at what we've done so far and whether it's succeeded. So first I looked at diets and the what we call meta-analysis, where they take all the studies on diets and they look at the good ones and look at the results. The meta-analysis of dieting shows that really dieting doesn't work, and in particular we don't want to get children started on dieting early in life. And pretty much any diet you go on, if you go on it faithfully, you'll lose about 8 to 11 pounds, sometimes a little bit more. But within a year or two, usually you've gained that back. And there's no one diet which is the great diet, because I've lived through the all grapefruit diet, the no citrus diet, the all carbohydrate diet, the no carbohydrate diet, the all fat diet, the no fat diet.
It is interesting because one comes out and this is the thing, and then all of a sudden there's scientific evidence of exactly the opposite within a year or two.
Exactly. And if you get a celebrity or a celebrity doctor to promote this diet, then it'll be the fad for a while. There's a new one in Japan now, which is the banana diet. You eat 3 bananas first thing in the morning and then more bananas during the day. And they sold out of bananas in a lot of grocery stores in Japan. But how diets work, essentially, at the very bottom, is if you restrict certain foods from your diet, you're probably going to lose weight for a while, as long as you're not eating those. So if you don't eat fat, then you'll probably lose weight. But if you eat only fat, you lose weight for a while, if you really stick to the diet. But that's not healthy either, because we need a well-balanced diet. That's what we're designed as in terms of evolution, to be out there grazing and hunting and picking up whatever we can, roots, leaves, animal meat when we can, eggs and here and there, insects, worms, whatever we could get. And protein is way overemphasized. You know, historically, protein wasn't such a huge part of our diet. It was more like a treat. So just to back up again, I looked at diets. They don't work, and we don't want to impose them on children. Then I looked at what we've done to food. I call this the attack on food. And what we did was strip food of sugar, nutrients, fiber, fat, and so on. And then we stuffed back in whatever we thought was important, vitamins, minerals, artificial fat. You know, they have this artificial fat, and the warning now is if you eat something with this artificial fat, you'll probably get diarrhea. A hint that maybe it's not helpful for you.
Right.
Artificial sweeteners and so on. So it's not the fault of food. Food is just food. But we're very technologically oriented in this society, and we think, well, science can solve this. I'll still be able to eat how I want, but I'll just take this pill, or I'll just eat something that's substituted fake fat for real fat, and it doesn't work. So then the next attack was on fat, and that's liposuction and so on. Now, there are days when I would be happy to have a liposuction because gravity takes its toll on all of us, you know, and things begin to migrate downward.
Right.
I told my girlfriend, who's also a physician, I said, we should have started sleeping upside down when we were about 30. But what happens with liposuction is that when you remove fat cells from one part of the body, they just grow in another part of the body because their job is to store extra fuel for lean times, and then to have it available for us, say the fall crop in our farm didn't do well, it failed, and we're facing a winter with little food. Well, it'd be really helpful if we have stored some fuel up in our fat cells. So the war on fat hasn't worked particularly well. And now there's the war that you mentioned. It just is appalling to me. The war on our poor gastrointestinal system, our stomach and our intestines, as if they're at fault. I mean, all they're doing is digesting food and absorbing food, whatever we put in. They try their best. And it just appalled me when I first read about it that my profession, the medical profession, was surgically mutilating people in order to help them lose weight. And I thought, surely they will never, ever do this with children. Well, guess what? They're doing it with adolescents now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wow. It's just appalling. We don't know the long-term consequences. We have no idea.
Appalling is not a strong enough word for that.
Yeah. I think we'll look back on it and we'll say, barbaric.
Yeah. I don't think we'll look back. I would say that right now. The thing that I'm trying to figure out is, how do these get started? You know, anorexia and bulimia and these wars we take out on our body. You must have studied some of the psychological, some of the cultural media aspects of it. How does 8-10-year-old girl, say, start purging and, you know, doing the things that they do at such early ages?
Yeah. Well, there's some research now which helps us look at early ages and try to see what's going on. For example, if you put babies in high chairs and then put a variety of foods on the tray in their high chair, they will eat a balanced diet. They will eat the appropriate amount of calories in a well-balanced diet, but it's over the course of a week. It's not in any one day. So one day,
they'll eat all potatoes or something.
Exactly. The next day, all Cheerios, and the next day, all applesauce. And mothers can't stand that. That's just too nerve-wracking. So they will inevitably say, open your mouth, eat this. You can't, you know, it starts this whole thing of you can't leave the table until you've eaten your blah, blah, blah. Or I've actually seen a mother hold a child in her arms, holding the child's arms down so they couldn't struggle, and then just force feed them. You wouldn't believe what goes on out there at home. So by about age 5, the current research shows, kids are now eating by pressure, rules, criticism, and social norms, so-called norms. So the next study is that they compare 3-year-olds and 5-year-olds, and they give them large plates of macaroni and cheese, way more than they should be eating. And they sit them down in front of these large plates of macaroni and cheese. And the 3-year-olds will eat enough and then leave. But the 5-year-olds will valiantly try to eat the whole thing and eat about 60% more than they should. So we think that very early on, sometime between around toddler age, parents start intervening. Well, we know this happens. Start intervening out of good intention. So this is based usually in love or concern or anxiety for the child's health. They will start intervening and forcing the child to eat what they think the child should eat. I can't tell you how many people in the mindful eating workshops, as we're doing the workshop, suddenly they'll remember, oh yeah, I had to sit at the table for hours. They remember sitting there from dinner until dark because the rule was if you don't finish what's on your plate, you can't leave the table.
Oh, I had that. And guilt on top of it. You know, there's people starving in China.
Exactly.
That was
exactly.
Wow.
So people have told me they would sit there for 2 or 3 hours until somebody did, until they fell asleep on the table or somebody would come and intervene. Now, what's unfair about that, and children have an intuitive sense of what's not fair, is that the adult served the food and the amount of food, the kind of food and the amount of food, and then said, you must eat it. And that's intrinsically unfair. So there's a wonderful person who writes on this subject about children and eating. And her rule of thumb is, see if I can remember it, parents control when and what kind of food children eat. Children control which foods and how much. Mm. So children should be allowed to be able to pick what they eat and how much. And the studies are really clear that when we violate that, when parents with all their good intentions come in and start trying to control what children eat, you have a much higher incidence of eating disorders later.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know, one of the thoughts I had, I don't think you address this in your book, but it seems kind of obvious, is what's the relationship of these kinds of eating disorders to socioeconomic place in society? I know that in poorer neighborhoods, the only place to buy food is the liquor store, for instance.
Right, or the convenience store at the gas station.
Right. So have you done studies on that or any thought about that?
Well, this is a real problem, and I think First Lady Michelle Obama is working on this directly. That in it's a cycle that gets perpetuated generation after generation. So we have some kids who are the third generation being raised on fast food, convenience food, and they literally don't know the taste of fresh tomatoes or fresh grapes or how to cook. The parents don't know how to cook. So we have to really unwind back to some of these programs that I think are so great. There's one called the Edible Schoolyard.
Oh, great program.
Yeah, where kids, they found that kids who wouldn't touch broccoli or a fresh tomato, because they've literally never had experience with it, if they grow it in the garden at school and then they help prepare it, they eat it and they love it. So we have to help families garden with community gardens or backyard gardens and then learn how to prepare the food, and then kids get involved in that either at school or ideally at home.
Yeah,
but it's gonna take a while to reverse all of this.
Yeah, especially in changing times we're in. So we've kind of laid out what the issue, and you've done a great job of that. Let's talk to the key aspect of your book, Mindful Eating. Well, what is mindfulness, and what is mindful eating? And I'm particularly interested in how does that address the source of our eating problems?
Well, ultimately, the source is we're not paying attention. And that's true of all of us, of course. There are definitely times when I eat mindlessly. Hopefully I'm aware, this is the time when I'm eating mindlessly. So what is mindful eating? Mindful eating is deliberately paying attention to the internal environment, so that's the body, the mind, and the heart, and to the external environment, that would be the food and the social environment, so on, as we eat. And the key part of this is without judgment or criticism. And that's really essential. And that's what you were saying when the guilt comes in early on, you know, eat this because there's starving children in China. Well, it's not like your parents are going to pack up your food and send it off to China, so you feel guilty. And maybe your parents grew up during the Depression or had parents who grew up during the Depression, so food was scarce, and so that there's that extra pressure. I've put this food on the table, eat it. I didn't have something like this when I was a child.
And how does one cultivate mindfulness?
Well, it takes some retraining. Children are pretty good at mindful eating if you watch them. They really love to explore textures and smells and tastes and colors and smear food around, play with it. But we lose that very early because we start double tasking. So we start reading and eating. We start watching TV and eating. That's fatal in terms of childhood obesity. All the studies are really clear. The more TV you watch, the more likely you're going to be to be overweight and in poor health in childhood and then from then on. So we eat and watch TV. We now play computer games, video games, and watch TV in childhood and early adolescence. And then we do email. We talk on the telephone while eating. And then, so if you're doing that, because the mind can't pay attention to two things at once, you can't be paying attention to the food. And when you're not paying attention to the food, it's almost as if you didn't eat it. The example I always give is, I love lemon tarts, and there's somebody who once a month usually brings me a lemon tart, just lovely lemon tart from a bakery in Portland. And I will sit down and take my first bite, and it is so good, that beautiful combination of sweet and sour and pastry and creamy and
Oh, come on, you're making me hungry.
I know. That's called ear hunger.
That's right. We'll talk about that in a while.
That's called ear hunger when I can make you hungry by describing it.
We'll get to that.
So then I take a bite and I just savor it. It's so delicious. Then I take the second bite and I think, oh, you know, I've got this important email coming up. I better check Michael Stone and make sure I'm still on for an interview with Michael Stone. And so then I check my email, and then I check another email, and then maybe I check eBay or whatever, Facebook. And then I look down, and there's only a few crumbs on the plate. And I go, where did my lemon tart go?
Who took my lemon tart?
And then I realize, well, I must have eaten it. There's nobody else around. So then the natural thing is to think, well, I need another one. I didn't really taste that one. I didn't really get full enjoyment out of it. So the cure for that, and we've all fallen prey to it, is to eat your first few bites and then stop. Because there's a kind of extinction phenomenon in the nervous system that, and you can try it eating one bite, two bites, three bites. By the third or fourth bite, the taste has gone way down no matter what we're eating. And so then we usually stuff in more or put more hot sauce on or more salt on, whatever, to up the intensity of the taste. And the processed food companies know this. If you go through the store and read labels, you know, they have more intense, more salt, more hot, the sourest you've ever eaten sort of labels, because we love that food experience, which is intense on the first or second bite. The tongue loves pleasure. The tongue loves sensation. And so we keep trying to recapture that. And in fact, there's one researcher who's worked with binge eaters told me that some of her clients have told her that when they're binge eating, they're trying unsuccessfully to recapture the sensation, the intensity of the sensation of the first bite. And so they keep eating more bites, but of course it doesn't work. Actually, the intensity goes down.
You know, I'm wondering, Jan, what's the relationship of thinking to mindfulness?
Were you thinking about that?
I was thinking about it, exactly. That's what I was noticing, that I was thinking about it.
Don't be eating while you're thinking about it. No, that's really a good question. I've been a Zen teacher, a Zen practitioner for 35 years and a Zen teacher for almost as long. 30 years, and it's very clear from working with my own mind and also many other people's students' minds that the mind has two basic functions. There's the thinking function, which you just mentioned, and then there's the awareness function. And it's very hard to be thinking and be very aware at the same time. Really, the two are almost exclusive. We've all had the experience of, we start thinking about something really important to us. Maybe I would be daydreaming about my garden. What am I going to plant in my garden this spring? And then we suddenly come back to reality and we realize, oh my gosh, I don't know what's been going on the last 5 minutes. It could happen when we're driving. It happens often when we're driving. So when we're really thinking hard, pondering hard, planning and creating in the mind, we're not aware of what's going on around us. And mindful eating says switch off the thinking function and turn on the awareness function full force while you're eating, and you will enjoy much less food, much more. You'll be eating less and enjoying it much more. And when you learn to pay attention to internal signals, you'll be eating more appropriately too.
Mm. Okay, so here I am, a little overweight. I've decided, all right, I want to get started with this, creating a healthier relationship to what I put in my body, to the food I put in my body. How do I get started with this basic mindfulness and eating meditation that you're talking about?
Sure. Well, it's really step by step. Often people will read the book or come to a mindful eating workshop and they get overwhelmed. They think, oh my goodness, I have to change how I eat entirely. But that doesn't work. That's like dieting. That's like trying to flip something upside down, and it won't stay that way. So we recommend start with one step at a time. For example, are you a coffee drinker or a tea drinker?
Mainly a tea drinker.
Tea drinker,
an occasional cup of coffee.
Yeah, okay. Well, it works either way. So in the morning, your first cup of tea or your first cup of coffee, you stop what you're doing, sit down, and the first few sips, really enjoy the whole experience. So feel the warmth of the coffee cup and then also the hardness of the coffee cup, and then smell, look at the coffee or the tea, look at the color. Maybe if it's coffee, it's got cream swirling around in it. Look at the steam coming off the cup. Smell it, inhale the fragrance. A lot of our eating pleasure comes from fragrance, actually, not taste. Taste is mostly smell. So inhale, and then, like you would with a fine wine, you know, move the cup away, exhale, and move it back, inhale a few times, and think, well, if I had to describe this, again, like a wine taster, how would I describe this? Is this young and boisterous, or is it fruity, or is it have an undercurrent of cinnamon? You know, the ad people know how to do this.
Boy, don't they.
Yeah. And then you take your first sip, and you close your eyes and take your first sip and really enjoy it in the mouth, and then even see if you can feel it going down. Often you can feel that warmth spreading through your body as it goes down your esophagus. And then pause for a bit, and, you know, just even a few seconds, pause, and then take your second sip. And then you've done your mindful eating exercise or mindful drinking exercise with that cup of coffee or tea. And then you can go on with what you're doing. So we start with baby steps like that.
Yeah.
Or you try one meal a day or one snack a day. I will eat mindfully. I will do nothing else while I am enjoying this. Now, that's a little embarrassing for us. We're very much into the Puritan ethic of our value is measured by how much we produce in a day. So it's at first very hard for some people to just stop, look away from the computer, maybe turn and look out the window, and eat your sandwich, and just eat your sandwich. Look at the texture of the bread, the color of the lettuce, the mayonnaise, and just really enjoy all the taste down to the last crumb. And then go back to your work.
Yeah, I have to admit, I am a recovering multitasker,
mm-hmm.
but I fail miserably most of the time. But I am slightly recovering.
That's good. That's exactly how you do it. You start with little steps. I mean, all of us, when we're really in a rush, the example I give in the book is, if I'm on my way to testify in court on a child abuse case and I haven't had time to really go through the chart, and I'm a little bit late, and I haven't had breakfast or lunch because it's been a really hectic day at the hospital, and I know I need to stop, I'll pull into a Burgerville and get something to eat and drink, and then I'll eat it while I'm driving. And I just say to myself, now I'm going to eat mindlessly.
I'm glad that you, the expert, also do that once in a while.
Absolutely,
at least.
Absolutely. People think
but you do it consciously. You know what, you say, this is what I'm going to do right now because that's what's available, right?
I try to.
Do you forgive yourself?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yes, absolutely. We have to. That's part of
we
it.
We do.
No criticism, no judgment. The best kind of change, it happens in small increments slowly. So you're building a foundation, stone by stone, minute by minute, drink by drink, a foundation that then you can build up on.
Yeah. Another thing that I was really fascinated was how you delineated the different kinds of hunger and how we can satisfy them. Can you talk about the seven different hungers you talk about in mindful eating?
Sure. Well, this is something I made up, but I made it up based on many, many years of doing mindful eating and talking with people about their experiences. So we start with eye hunger, and eye hunger is what the eyes take in and then say to the body, oh, let's eat this. And the best example of eye hunger is you have eaten at a restaurant and you're completely stuffed, and the waitress comes and says, would you like dessert? And you say, oh, no, please, I'm just really, really, really full. I couldn't eat a thing. But then she brings the dessert tray, and the eyes look at the dessert tray and they say, we could eat that.
Especially that lemon tart, huh?
That's right. And with the lemon tart, definitely. There's room for that in there somewhere, right, stomach? But the stomach isn't actually consulted. And so we eat it. And then we regret it. We go, oh, gosh, I shouldn't have eaten that. So that's eye hunger. There are other examples of eye hunger. When you leaf through a magazine like Gourmet Magazine and you see some beautiful creation and you get hungry.
My mouth waters. Oh, that's a different kind of hunger, though. Yeah.
Well, no, but your eyes have given you the information, right? Or you're in the movie theater and they have these huge things of Butterfingers or popcorn up on the screen and everybody gets up and goes to get some popcorn. That's based on eye hunger. Or even reading a recipe. You can get hungry reading a recipe. That's eye hunger. So take whatever the eyes take in, they make you hungry. Then next is nose hunger, and the best example of that is the Cinnabon in the shopping mall or in the airport. So you've eaten, you're perfectly satisfied, but you walk down the concourse and you smell that Cinnabon smell, which I'm sure they just pipe all over the place. And you think, well, I could just get one because they don't feed you much on the plane and I'll just nibble on it. And there you go. You got your Cinnabon. So there's nose hunger. Then next is mouth hunger. And really the mouth is key. The mouth is really, really important because, as I mentioned before, the mouth loves sensation. It loves changes in sensation, too. So it likes salty. It likes sweet. It likes fat. They've just found that there are fat receptors on the tongue. Many more receptors than that old map, which is completely outdated, the tongue map, you know, salty here, sugar there, and so on. There are receptors for what they call umami, which is protein, fish, meat, a kind of savory sensation on the tongue, also found in mushrooms and seaweed. And broth of various kinds. And then there's sour, and then there's bitter. And then they think that now the tongue has receptors for calcium and also metallic taste, like if you suck on your finger when it's bleeding, there's a metallic taste. And, of course, a lot of young people now have metal in their mouths, so the pierced tongues and so on, they would be tasting metal. So the tongue, then the tongue loves textures. Besides different tastes, it loves different textures. So the tongue loves creamy, and it loves crunchy, and everything in between. And what I tell people is, has your tongue ever told you, stop giving me sensations? Really, the only time it says that is when you fall asleep. Stop giving me sensations. It might say, enough sweet, please switch to salty. Or enough salty, please switch to bland and creamy. But the tongue really loves sensation. So we have to be aware of that. I call the tongue a desire monger. It's just full of desire. The mouth is full of desire.
Yeah.
Then next is stomach hunger. And this is one that all the research has found, and we have found in the workshops. People are really out of touch with their stomachs. So we ask people, before you eat, and this would be maybe the second thing to try with mindful eating, is before you eat, put your awareness in your gut, in your stomach, and try to gauge how full is it. Is it empty? Is it half full? Is it three-quarters full? Is it all the way full, or is it over full? And often people, when they do that, they're ready to eat, and they realize, wait a minute, I'm full already. What am I doing eating? So the stomach is really key, if you can tune into stomach hunger. A lot of people have tuned that out, especially if they've been overeating a lot or have been anorexic. They lose their awareness of what the stomach can tell them about eating.
In your book, you talk about the Japanese hiragi, about the stomach wisdom. Speak about that. I was fascinated by that.
Yes, most Asian cultures have a saying, which would be something like, the first four-fifths are for you, the last fifth is for the doctor. Or eat four-fifths full and then drink and then rest. I think there was an Indian sage who said, eat two-thirds and then drink one-third and then stop. So there's a recognition in those cultures of don't eat till you're stuffed. But in America, we've gotten this idea that you're not full till you're stuffed. So there's a difference between satisfied. We try to teach people the difference between satisfied and full and stuffed. One woman who did the mindful eating workshop, I didn't see her for several years, and when I saw her, I said, whoa, you really look different. She said, well, I've lost about 30 pounds. I said, how did you do that? And she said, well, after the mindful eating workshop, I pondered, why do I eat? And I realized, well, I eat so that my body will feel at peace. When I'm hungry, I feel out of balance and out of alignment. And when I eat, then I feel at peace. So I just adopted the strategy of eat till I feel at peace. So she would eat some. She would check in. Does my body feel at peace? Not yet. And then she would eat. And then as soon as she felt at peace, she would stop.
Mm.
And that's related to stomach hunger and body hunger. So next is body hunger. And that one's quite subtle. And we usually don't recognize that unless we're sick. So, for example, I'll ask you this. When you have the flu and you've had the stomach flu and nothing stayed down for a while and then you're recovering but you're still a little wobbly, what is it that you eat?
Usually juice for me.
Juice? Mm-hmm. What kind of juice?
Well, I like carrot juice, actually.
Mm-hmm. Very good choice, actually.
Yeah. I like using something I've just been doing recently is the slow pressing of vegetable juices.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Great.
So I like that.
Yeah.
And I always have made chicken soup. I'm a chicken soup guy. Make chicken soup for any time anyone that I love is sick. That's what I do, make chicken soup.
Every culture has their equivalent of chicken soup. So in Asia, it's miso soup or a kind of rice, well-cooked rice broth. So this is when the body is telling you, I just need liquid with a minimum amount of solid, and I need my electrolytes back. So the soup has sodium, potassium, chloride, and so on in it, which is what your body needs after you've been ill like that, especially if you've been losing food out both ends.
You had a lovely story about the body-mind. You know, there's like a war going on sometimes between the body and the mind.
Yeah.
And you shared a story about your daughter. That was a wonderful story. You want to share that with our listeners?
Sure. We adopted a daughter at the end of the Vietnam War from Vietnam, and she was quite emaciated when she came to us. And she would sit at the table and cry if we started to take food away when everybody else had finished eating. Because she couldn't stand for food to be removed. She felt she had to eat it all because she'd obviously been through times of famine. And then she would also put food in her pocket and carry it around, and we would find it hidden in drawers and so on. Again, the storing up for famine time. But one of the most interesting things that happened is during that period, we served something that she didn't like. And she became so frustrated. She started to cry because she desperately wanted to eat it because it was food, and there might, you know, in her mind of 7 years old, of 7 years of starvation, there might not be food in an hour. So her mind was telling her, eat it, you've got to eat it. But she didn't like it. So her mouth and the rest of her body was saying, don't eat it. And she just became tremendously frustrated and just broke down into tears. And it took her maybe 3 to 4 months to realize that food was always available. It was okay not to eat everything on the table in the serving dishes, and you don't have to eat what you don't like.
And has she continued to practice?
Yes.
You know, being around you, I would imagine she would. But
yeah, she's an adult now, but she's,
yeah, that's what
good,
I'm saying.
Good,
yeah.
Healthy eater.
That's great.
And good, healthy weight.
Great. You have an awareness exercise in your book on going through each of these hungers as an exercise and judging them on a scale of 0 to 10. How does that work?
Well, we start with an exercise where you eat something simple. The classic mindful eating exercise is a raisin. And you first start by looking at the raisin and asking, if I just pick this up on the surface of a foreign planet, if I were on a spaceship that crashed and we didn't have any food and we didn't have any scientific equipment, and I went out searching for something that might be edible and I found this object, this brown, wrinkly object, and I just looked at it with my eyes, what would my eye hunger be? And most people say, it looks like an animal dropping. My eye hunger is about 0 or 1. And then they smell it, and it smells fruity. And so what is nose hunger, we ask, and that usually goes up a few points. Then they put it in their mouth, roll it around, and we start assessing mouth hunger. And with the first bite, there's this intense burst of sweet flavor. And so immediately mouth hunger is up maybe 7, 8, 9, really high. So that's how we do it. Mindful eating is based on experience. It's not based on reading. And so mindful eating is not reading about mindful eating. Mindful eating is not reading about mindful eating while eating.
Especially.
Especially, right? But it's actually doing the exercises, and it's so much fun. People just, they come to the monastery thinking, oh, they're just going to feed us brown rice and pickles, but we actually have very delicious vegetarian food. And people have so much fun during the workshop because mindful eating helps you discover the truth for yourself. Nobody is telling you the truth because each person's truth is a little different. That's another aspect of mindful eating. So we'll eat in the mindful eating workshop, we eat something, and then we say, okay, what was your experience? And one person may have the opposite experience of somebody else. For instance, do you know cilantro? It's also called Chinese parsley. It's the green
yes.
herb.
Mm-hmm. I hate it. But anyway.
Do you?
I do. I just okay. can't stand it. Tastes like
taste
soap.
Like? What does it taste like?
Tastes like soap. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you're among the 1 in 10 who hate the taste of cilantro. And they usually describe it as soap, crushed insects, sweaty socks.
Sweaty socks. I like that one. Yeah.
And we didn't know that until I started doing research here, and I found it out, and I asked the people living at the monastery, and sure enough, one person, same as you, disgusting. So now we serve it only on the side. So we don't know what something tastes like to somebody else. There's no way to know that. So each person's experience is different, and that, and mindful eating respects that.
Yeah.
It's a journey of discovery, and it's adventure. You use your curiosity more than anything else. It's really fun.
Yeah. Of course, you're going to have a lot of discovery of habitual behavior and conditioning.
Yes.
Does just the process take care of that without doing anything that you, when you understand and see enculturated habits and a life of conditioning, do you just begin to change the habits then? Is that how that works?
At least you have the opportunity. So
choice is the issue there.
The choice is the issue, and awareness is the key. So when we don't have awareness, then something is unconscious. So these conditioned habit patterns from our childhood are unconscious. And then they're controlling us. They're driving us from the inside. But when we bring the light of awareness to our eating, it's amazing how things will pop up from people's past. One woman, we were doing a listing of comfort foods, and she said, oh, I love raspberry yogurt as a comfort food. And then she said, somebody said, well, why raspberry? She said, I have no idea. Why raspberry? And then she suddenly opened her eyes and she said, oh, I remember. My grandmother was diabetic and was not allowed to have sweets, but she had a hidden store of raspberry jam in her room. And when I was a child, I would go in there and she would close the door and we would feast on raspberry jam. So it represented her grandmother's love. And that's how it became a comfort food.
Yeah. That's great.
And many discoveries like that made during the mindful eating workshops.
Tell us about the unholy trio.
So fat, salt, and sugar I call the unholy, holy trio. Unholy because they have become our obsession. And the processed food companies know that very well. And they are meticulously balancing the sweetness, the sugar, and the fat, the sweetness, salt, and fat in processed food so that we will crave it. Really, they have scientists working on this very, very carefully. Now, they're also the holy trio because they were essential to our survival, and that's why we like them so much.
Yeah.
Sugar is a very quick source of energy. We can't store sugar in our body. We can make it over time. We can reconvert it. We can reconvert other things, carbohydrates and fat, for example, into quick energy sources, but that takes time. So fat is a slow energy reservoir, and sugar is a quick energy reservoir, fuel source. But if you look historically at our evolution for 200,000 years, we had very, very little in the way of sugar. Dried fruit, like dried dates, the Egyptians had that, dried figs. Some honey when beekeeping began, and before that, you'd have to go out, climb a tree, smoke the bees out, get stung, fall out of the tree, break your leg, knock down this comb, and then the comb is from wild bees. It's all messy. It's filled with little larval bees and dirt and junk, and you'd have to extract the honey out of it. And each person in the tribe would get 2 teaspoons. When I was in Australia, they told me about the Aborigines dig for hours to dig up what they call honey ants. And these are little ants that have a swollen body full of a sweet liquid. And they'll dig for hours to get a few honey ants.
Wow.
And way more calories put out than calories you get back from the sweetness. But we love sweetness.
Well, that's a big thing that you talk about, too. I forgot about that. The exchange, the energy in versus the energy out.
Yes. Sure. So the example I gave for sugar is I looked at if there were a Native American woman who lived on the land the monastery is now on in Oregon, next to the Columbia River, and before white settlers came, if she wanted something sweet, what would she be able to get? And it turns out to be basically blackberries, wild blackberries, which aren't terribly sweet, and some huckleberries, which also aren't terribly sweet. They're the precursor of blueberries. So I figured, well, if she gathered them for about 2 hours, she'd get about this much calories in berries. But then she would expend more calories than that, walking to the site and gathering the berries. But if she were an American Indian woman today, she could hop in her car and drive down to Burgerville. Well, they have a huckleberry shake or a blackberry shake. It's got something like 900 calories in it. And she would have expended about 32 calories to get there and back. So we in our historical past put out lots of effort to get a little bit of sweetness, a little bit of salt, a little bit of fat, and that's how we stayed lean.
Right.
But now we don't have to do that. So the second part of the trio is salt, and human beings can't store salt, can't manufacture salt in their body, and carnivores get it from meat and blood, but we're actually designed more to be vegetarian with some supplement of our diet from meat or fish or chicken or eggs. Or dairy, but we human beings used to follow animals to salt licks. And for example, Lewis and Clark, when they came to the West Coast, the first thing they did was set up a salt factory on the ocean shore, to get enough salt to preserve their meat and so on. So, our blood has to have a certain amount of salts in it for us to survive. So. Salt was really important, and there were kingdoms that rose and fall on salt. Fascinating history if you read the history of salt. And then fat is the long-term storehouse. And in ancient times, if the tribe was able to bring down a buffalo or bring down a woolly mammoth or kill a whale, then you wanted to eat as much as you could, especially the fat parts, and store that away because there could be months or even years of famine coming. And that was, if you were going to survive and your kids were going to survive, that was really important. And especially for women, because they were storing up not for them, just for themselves, but they might be carrying a pregnancy or nursing a child, so they had to have more calories stored up.
Wow. Well, we're getting close to the end of our hour together, Jen. Boy, it always goes so fast. I'd like to end with you talking about the simple guidelines that you have put in your book, Mindful Eating, about how to do that, the six basic guidelines. Could you go over those for us?
Sure. Let me just kind of a summary of mindful eating.
Mm-hmm.
Here. We didn't talk about the mind hunger, and mind hunger is critical because the mind tells us all kinds of crazy things, which are often not so relevant. That's part of anorexia, actually, which we didn't have a lot of time to talk about. But in anorexia, the mind takes over the desire to control and the inner critic talking to us about what we should or shouldn't eat, or how much we should or shouldn't weigh, or how we look in the mirror. That's mind hunger. So I guess in summary, I would say from the book, mindful eating is about opening the mind's awareness to our food and to our body before, during, and after we eat. And mindful eating is non-judgmental, non-critical, non-judgmental. And awareness is the key to change. If we're not aware of something, it's not going to change. Once we're aware of it, it can't stay the same. So awareness of what we're doing while we're eating, and awareness of our body and heart and mind, and of the food itself, especially in our mouth, will bring up small conditioned awareness of our conditioned habit patterns, and then they can begin to change. But we have to change them in small ways. Little by little, eventually produces large changes. What we ask people to do is when they sit down to eat, to assess particularly stomach hunger, and then try to fill up only about 4/5 full, and then drink something and then rest. And if you're not hungry, don't eat. If you're not hungry and you're going to eat anyway, then somebody suggests, say out loud, "I'm not hungry, but I'm going to eat this anyway." Just say it out loud so you can see how absurd it is. But if you're not hungry, it's fine not to eat. And then in terms of starting small, if we can be present for the first 3 sips of something we're drinking or the first 3 bites of something we're eating, then that's a great start. Take small portions for firsts and consider waiting at least 20 minutes, which is the time it takes for the feedback signals to get back from the stomach and the intestines to say, "I'm full." This we call the satiety signals. "We're getting full here. Please stop." So if you serve yourself the amount of food that will leave you 2/3 to 4/5 full, and then drink something and rest, then that works really well. Eating slowly, savoring the bites, and what we recommend is putting the utensil down. That was considered part of good manners a couple generations ago. Put your fork or your spoon down between bites. Savor that bite, swallow it, enjoy it, and then, only then, pick up the utensil. I call that put down that spoon. Chew thoroughly. People have told us they realize that they don't chew their food. They just bolt it. So slow down by chewing thoroughly. And then really recognize when we're satisfied, and that might be different from full. We're often satisfied before we're feeling stuffed or full. And then not to be self-critical. As I said, mindful eating also includes mindless eating, but just be aware that that's what you're doing at the time. Empty is important. We're often afraid to be empty, but we're not in a famine situation anymore. And it's okay to be empty and feel the sensations of empty. And often when we're empty and really hungry, we enjoy what we're eating so much more than if we've been eating all day long. I think the last tip is know that the heart is asking to be fed, and to know how to feed the heart without having to eat. So the heart hunger is the key, and heart hunger can be filled up with meditation or prayer, walking in nature, listening to or making music, playing with a child or a pet, being with someone you love, or just sitting and being present with what's in the room with you. So really the heart is filled with the richness of this moment if we can really be attentive to it.
Well, Jan Chosen Bays, I just want to thank you for this wonderful book. I still have many questions, and I'm sure our listeners still do. So I want to recommend this book, Mindful Eating, A Guide to Rediscovering a Healthy and Joyful Relationship with Food. And now one of the things in the Buddhist tradition is to end with a merit. Would you like to say one, or shall I read the one at the end of your book?
Sure, you can read the one at the end of the book.
May we all become free from anxiety and fear about eating. May we all be at ease. May we all be content as we nourish this precious human body and mind. May our hearts be happy and satisfied as we walk the path of awakening. Jan Chosen Bays, thank you so much for your work and for being on Conversations.
Thank you so much, Michael. I really enjoyed my time with you.
Me too. Great blessings.
You too. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Conversations is an independently produced program supported by KVMR 89.5, Nevada City, and listener contributions. We are committed to bringing you leading-edge thinking in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. If you would like to receive our complimentary newsletter, The Well of Light, make a contribution, or order any of our past shows, please call 530-477-7757 or go to our website at rwelistening.net.